You and I back together again. Busy show Thursday, October 28th, 2021, right here on Connecticut Today. NYU Professor Lawrence Mead joined us to talk about Afghanistan, which is still a major headache for the world, but it's kind of fallen off the front pages. Frances Calzetta talked about a lawsuit that her group, American-Italian Women of Greater New Haven, has filed against the city of New Haven, this regarding the city's recently removed Christopher Columbus statue in Worcester Square. Mark Fitch of the Yankee Institute checked in to talk about his new report on how millions of dollars in state-imposed fees are actually spent, or maybe not, on what you and I thought they would be. And I had a few thoughts as to why, actually, a criminal with numerous arrests was allowed back on the street and is now connected to a murder and an attempted murder. Why does Connecticut allow this? So here we are on this merry-go-round over and over and over again, where we have generally half of the folks in Connecticut have of any authority in politics or law enforcement saying, hey, we have a problem here with criminality in the state. And then we have a lot of people on the other side say, well, no, yeah, there's an aberration here or there. Don't get excited. Look at the numbers. They always point to the trends. That's what the left in this state loves to do. Oh, the trends. Everybody's having a problem. Oh, everybody is. Don't get mad at people because they've just lost their way. Well, look. There's a big difference between losing your way, being a first or second time arrestee, and maybe we have programs of intervention there to keep people on the straight and narrow. But listen, when you are an affirmed dirtbag, at least at this point in your life, we have to start dropping the hammer more on these people. We have to find out, and I don't want to hear about any sort of, upper level deep discussions about this. The answer is probably simple if you really look for it. Why are people in this state, and we get these stories once a week, once every couple of weeks, a few times a month, why are we allowing dangerous criminals to walk the street here? Why are we doing that? Can anybody, I'm being honest here, I'm not doing this for effect, can anybody please explain this to me? Is it politics? Is it a lack of wanting to admit to a problem? Is this being done on purpose? I don't know. 31-year-old Jose Cajigas, apprehended after he tried to kill a cop. He's been charged for that in Hartford, a Hartford gang member, and he's a person of interest in another murder. Okay, and Hartford officials are looking at that. This all, going down a few days ago. The Hartford policewoman, the female officer that he tried to kill, is being spoken of as a hero for maintaining her composure, after she got her window shot out on the driver's side of her cruiser, and she stayed calm enough to radio the description of Cajigas and where he might be, and officers then were able to corral him in and take him in. And, of course, everybody now, the chief of police in Hartford, the mayor of Hartford, Luke Bronin, everybody is saying, with good reason, I might say, with good reason, how is this guy walking the streets? Cajigas, now I'll go back to what's here courtesy of the Hartford Current. Cajigas has a lengthy criminal record with more than a dozen arrests in Hartford. And here's the frosting on the insanity cake, kids. He was arrested just 11 days ago on weapons, narcotics, and violation of probation charges. That's according to police. Cajigas was ordered held on a $270,000 bond after that arrest, but was able to quickly post more than $19,000 in cash that Friday night to secure his release before he could be presented in open court the following week. How about that, huh? How about that? This guy, Cajigas, 31-year-old Jose Cajigas, innocent until proven guilty. I understand all that. You don't have to tell me that. A lengthy criminal record, more than a dozen arrests in Hartford. Arrested just 11 days prior to all this on weapons, narcotics, and violation of probation charges. That's according to police. That's not me saying it. That's what the cops are saying. They ordered him held on a $270,000 bond after that arrest, but he was able to post more than $19,000 in cash that Friday night to secure his release before he could be presented in open court the following week. The Hartford Police Chief and Mayor Luke Bronin said that raises dire questions about Connecticut's bond system, both suggesting earlier this week that Kajigas should have been held without bond until his case could have been reviewed further. Luke Bronin saying 11 days ago, our police officers arrested this individual for illegal possession of a firearm. He remained out. Yesterday, he murdered somebody and he attempted to assassinate a police officer. The mayor continued, we need to have a serious conversation about how that's possible. Mr. Mayor, and I've met Luke Bronin a few times. I don't agree with him a lot on policy, but he's a nice enough guy. You know, I've met Luke Bronin a few times, and I think he's sincere about this. Guy's a big city mayor, and he wants to see his city safe. Well, Mr. Mayor, you know, you on the Democratic side, you know, get together with some of your fellow Democrats in Hartford, and yes, Mr. Mayor, I agree with you, Mayor Bronin, in Hartford. You know, get some of the Democratic power brokers to have that conversation about the bail system and the system that, you know, holds criminals for a certain amount of time. I'm all for that. How about it? Remember about a couple of months ago or so, all we were talking about for a couple of days, primarily from a political angle, was Afghanistan. The U.S. pullout there, was it proper? Was it improper? Why the heck did we do it? The collapse of the government there, half the people were saying, well, of course that was going to happen. The other half of the punditry was saying, no, of course it wasn't going to happen. So what is going on in Afghanistan now, and do we bear any responsibility for that? Was all this for naught? Joining us right now is a professor of political science at NYU, and he's also the author of Burdens of Freedom, Cultural Differences, and or rather Cultural Difference and American Power. He's also host of the Poverty and Culture podcast. He has an interesting op-ed in the spectator.org, The Real Afghan Tragedy. And we welcome NYU Professor Lawrence Mead to the program. Professor yeah. Mead, it's Paul here on WICC. How are you?
Yeah, fine, thank you.
Well, boy, we were talking about this, Professor, what, like crazy, two and a half months ago. Everybody had an opinion on Afghanistan. And now, Professor, tragically, I would say, it's on page 73 of the newspaper or around there. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, as I said in the article, the real tragedy here is the failure of the government in Afghanistan. That is not something that's short term. It's in the news right now because of the American exit and the chaos surrounding that, but it's going to remain true for a long time. So we're going to keep hearing about Afghanistan whenever there are various disorders, breakdowns, and so on in that country. And there's also a good chance that it will once again be a source of terrorism aimed at Western countries. So it's not going to go away. And the underlying problem really isn't what the Americans did, but rather the inability of that country to form a coherent government.
Do you think, Professor, that in the years and years we spent there, you know, trying to set them on that path, was that ever a real possibility that they would be able to do that or not?
I don't think the feasibility was ever very great. The culture of the country is one that doesn't support strong government, and that's never been true. That is, they've been a chaotic country region, really, for centuries. The British, the Russians, now the Americans have gone in there and attempted to achieve order, and they never could do it. Because the country simply doesn't have a culture, a civic culture, that allows there to be an orderly regime. That's the great fact about Afghanistan, and also true of many other poor countries.
NYU Professor Lawrence Mead is the guest. We're talking about Afghanistan. Professor, hang on. We'll be right back to you. Got to do a quick break here. Traffic and weather together. More about You know, whither Afghanistan? What's the deal now that we're just about completely out, 20 years plus? What happened, and can that country ever become a smoothly functioning regime, if you will? Traffic and weather together right here, 336 on WICC. And of talking, a lot of folks two, 3 months ago were talking about Afghanistan, the pullout there of U.S. forces, and now we're getting only occasional reports of what's going on there. And again, another chapter seems in American history to show that it's very difficult to straighten out Afghanistan, as it were, to become a functioning nation. NYU professor of politics Lawrence Mead is the guest. He's also the author of Burdens of Freedom, Cultural Difference, and American Power. He's also host of the podcast Poverty and Culture, and he has an op-ed, a very good one, in Spectator.org, The Real Afghan Tragedy, he points out, as the collapse of the governing framework there. And, Professor, before we took the break, you talked about culture, and I know you stressed that. I can hear right away. That's interesting, because to really change the direction of any country, not just Afghanistan, there's got to be a shift in the overall culture. And that, I mean, I can only think that could take hundreds of years.
Well, the nearest parallel to it is what the British did in India. They governed India for almost 200 years. And in that time, they managed to install certain Western institutions. So there's a representative democracy. There's a court system. There's a modern, pretty good army. They have serious institutions in India, but they created by the English, who ruled for about two centuries. That's what it took to implant those ideas in Indian political culture. And even now, India is, I wouldn't say, as well-governed as the West, but at least it's headed in the right direction. But you can't do it overnight. And even the British failed to include Afghanistan in their empire. It was simply too disorderly. There was simply no basis for previous order. Whereas in India, you had a number of regional powers and potentates that they could work on. Afghanistan, you had an even more fragmentary situation. So they never were really able to control the country. And that's what you have to do first. You have to be able to control your territory before you can even talk about democracy and other good things.
So the fact, Professor, then, that we were seeing reports of more women being involved in culture and in jobs and in education, in Afghanistan, and some of these changes, you know, you'd say, well, that's good. Was that only, Professor, happening because there was a multinational force there holding off the Taliban?
Yes. Basically, American institutions and ideas and values came into Afghanistan primarily in and around the capital and installed what was, in effect, an American regime as long as American forces were there. But once they left, then you have the return of a traditional social order. The Taliban represent that. But the idea that they're going to be in control, it's very unlikely. They also are going to struggle to control that territory. So I don't think we're dealing with something that just affects America. We're dealing with a situation of chaos that's going to be a long-term problem for a lot of people.
Left alone and to its own devices, Professor, the governing regime of the Taliban now, is there any hope that in a relatively short time, maybe 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years, when another generation or two comes through, could they grow out of this? Could they one day look at each other and say, hey, let's move into the modern age here? We're being laughed at around the world.
Yeah. I think the odds of that are extremely low. There are some countries, India is one of them, another one would be Mexico, where there have recently been popular movements in favor of better government, especially opposition to corruption. So there is progress where countries slowly improve their political culture, but it takes a long time, and they're a long way from what America understands as good government. I mean, the really mysterious thing, the thing that requires real recognition, is the fact that the United States never had to go through this because we were already born well-governed. The British, who were already the best-governed country in the world, transferred their institutions to the United States. So even though we had differences with the British and we fought a revolution against them and we established our independence, we already had the essence of good government. And that's why Americans really don't understand the problems of poor countries, because we've never been there. We've never had to develop institutions from nothing. And that's why we keep trying to export democracy to these other poor countries. It just doesn't work.
Yeah, you know, Professor, it's funny you mentioned that. Professor Lawrence Mead of NYU is the guest.
Yeah.
I remember, had to be a bunch of years ago. We were floating cash rewards for information from villagers if they could help us find whatever Taliban or ISIS operatives were out there.
Yeah.
And somebody said, you can give them all the cash in the world. They don't relate to that. It's something where, you know, $1 million to them is $1 million to do what? You know, give them land, give them more animals. That's something that may pique their interest. But
yeah,
here, like we said, you know, we love cash rewards. Their society can't relate to that.
Well, but more fundamentally, in the United States and other Western countries, you don't have to bribe people to behave well, to pay their taxes, to obey the law, and so on and so on. People grow up believing that those things are correct. And if you don't do those things, it's your problem. And the authorities have a power to come and punish you for that. So we have strong institutions. And we also have government by consent, where the public is allowed to criticize government. And it's this combination of order and criticism, order and accountability, very, very strange, found really only in the Western world. It's only a couple of other countries which have achieved this. So we don't understand how strange that is. Most countries, there is either order or there is disorder, and we don't have this combination of order and freedom that you find in the Western world. The really strange thing isn't Afghanistan. The strange thing is America, the fact that we're able to do both have strong government and at the same time hold government accountable. That is very, very unusual, and we have to recognize how strange that is. And do everything we can to preserve it, because that is really at the core of the American achievement.
Absolutely. Finally, let me have you polish off your professorial crystal ball here, Professor, and gaze into it. And 5 years from now, when we talk on October 28th, 2025, I'm sorry, 2026, I should say, what's Afghanistan going to look like?
Pretty much what it looks like today. You're going to have a Taliban regime in power in Kabul, and power will actually be decentralized to a bunch of warlords in various provinces, and they will do pretty much what they've been doing for centuries and rule over territories to their own interest and with corruption and without good government. But there will be at least you won't have a war raging, and that's pretty much what Afghanistan has been like when things were good, when they were relatively peaceful.
Professor Lawrence M. Mead, professor of politics at New York University, author of Burdens of Freedom, Cultural Difference in American Power. Also, you'll find his podcast, Poverty and Culture. Check out his essay on the real Afghan tragedy at spectator.org. Professor, thank you. It's been wonderful. Hopefully we can chat down the road. I appreciate it.
Okay, Paul. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Professor Lawrence Mead. Good stuff there. He said, it is what it is. It's sad to say that about countries. But he made some really interesting points there, that some of the attitudes about government and being able to challenge our government and scream and yell about it and talk about it, but still being able to function is something that in Afghanistan and other parts of the world is just it's a foreign concept or concepts. A local group is demanding that the city of New Haven return a Christopher Columbus statue to Worcester Square. The American-Italian Women of Greater New Haven filing a lawsuit. Now, they say their rights were violated and they were discriminated against when the statue, which was given to the city by Italian Americans way back in 1892, was removed months ago. The suit names New Haven Mayor Justin Elliker, who says it's without merit, and he says it is, quote, this is what the mayor is saying, quote, it is draining city resources away from more pressing issues. Well, to talk about that is a representative of that group, and you can find them on Facebook. Francis Calzetta is joining us to talk about it. Hey, Francis, hi, it's Paul at WICC. Good afternoon. How are you?
I'm fine. Thank you.
The lawsuit, Francis, why go forward with this? It's an interesting suit from what I've read, And it talks about the statue, but I see, Francis, there are other issues here that you and the legal representation that you've retained want to contend here.
I'm not sure of what you're asking. Do you want me to explain what the lawsuit
sure,
is about?
Oh, sure, sure. And you know, the perceived, you know, the favoritism you think may be going on here. All the aspects here, in case there are people that really aren't up to speed on what's going on here.
Okay. The first and probably most important is it's a civil rights issue. The mayor chose another ethnic group over the Italian-Americans to take down the statue. He, in his own words to me in a telephone call, admitted that he did this because of the protests these groups were making. So this is firsthand, right from the horse's mouth. He is now claiming he has other costs, but he knew this was coming down the pike. If he didn't think it through thoroughly, that somebody was going to be filing a lawsuit, and he's known this is coming for a year and a half, or rather, since they took the statue down, because we were delayed in getting the lawsuit done because the city of New Haven, by way of the Mayor Elicker, refused to give us the information that we were looking for. Our attorney, Patricia Co-Francesco, went to the city to get the documents that were required to prove what was going on. The city stonewalled her. As a result, she had to go to the Freedom of Information people. So he can't come on and say this is something new and we're using his resources. He wastes a lot of money on a lot of other things anyway. And he ought to be looking at his school system, which is wasting multi-millions of dollars by incompetence and brainwashing the students into only democratic ways of thinking, bulletin boards around the school that are anti-Republican, anti-President Trump. He has a lot of nerve saying what he's saying, that we're wasting his money, the taxpayers' money. He's wasting it on any number of projects that he has. If you'll give me the city budget, I will show you where he's wasting
all right,
money.
Francis,
Mr. Elicker, don't come to us. You did something wrong. You were not expecting us to do this, and because you thought you were getting away with it, because we were delayed because of city stonewalling.
All right, Francis, hang on.
Time has come to pay the piper, Mayor Elicker.
I do.
Francis,
hang on. I got to take a break here. When we come back, we'll continue this. We will talk about this lawsuit filed against the city. Now, the city, apparently, is, from what I see, they're offering a different kind of statue, a different kind of tribute to Italians in the area. We'll talk about that coming up as a group has filed suit against New Haven saying, hey, and our guest says the mayor admitted to her that this was, in a sense, favoring one ethnic group over the other. First, though, we'll do traffic and weather together right here at 4:36 on WICC. The name of the group is the American Italian Women of Greater New Haven. American Italian Women of Greater New Haven. They're a nonprofit organization. Find them on Facebook. And speaking for that group, we continue with Francis Calzetta. The group has filed a civil rights lawsuit through New Haven attorney Patty Co-Francesco, very well-known attorney in the New Haven area, over the removal several months ago, back in June, of the Christopher Columbus statue from the Worcester Square area in New Haven, which is considered the heart of the Italian-American community in New Haven. Now, Francis, I understand, and I think I saw a mock-up of it, that the city is offering, or somebody is offering, a different or a new sculpture there to honor Italian.
What the mayor attempted to do, and Rosa DeLauro attempted to do, because they were covering their wrong decision, was to try to work on the immigration issue. And, of course, everybody in our group and most of people in greater New Haven area have their roots in New Haven, and not only Worcester Square. They call themselves the center, but we New Haveners, we Italian Americans, were all over the city. If you would read Riccio's books on the Italians of New Haven, we were in the Hill, we were in Fair Haven, we were in the Annex, we were in Morris Cove. They try to say they're the only place, but they are not. We are all, we were all over the city. Second and third generations moved to the suburbs for bigger homes. Mm-hmm. They had more education, more money.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah, so they couldn't have seen. The civil rights sue is that has in it a period of time over which discrimination against Italian Americans in favor of other ethnic groups, in many cases over a period of time, mm-hmm. creating a pattern of anti-Italian American. That is what the civil rights suit is. And the statue was just the crowning glory that the mayor of the city of New Haven took another ethnic group over New Haven.
Now,
to the other monument, many of us think it's a terrible one. I was on the committee for a while. I got off of it because they threw out all the suggestions that had come in. 70% did not want immigration. They wanted famous Italians. They wanted famous American Italians. The group, mostly of who are bonded because they grew up in that area and they are bonded to Rosa DeLauro. And all Rosa wanted was immigration, immigration, immigration. And when they did it, they came up with a terrible image of what Italian American immigration people were. They made the father look profound and the women look very, very weak. This is not the Italian culture. In the Italian culture, the father had a particular kind of authority. The mother had a particular kind of authority.
Oh, I know.
That particular statue is a terrible, terrible rendition of immigration. But what's the worst part about it is this particular committee threw out all other suggestions, and they only wanted to do what Rosa wanted. With that, I got off the committee. I wrote the mayor a letter. He didn't have the concern. He did not have the courtesy to get back to me.
And I did see the image of the statue, and I did read and hear the particular depiction of the mother, the woman there, was disconcerting to you and some other people. What were some of the ideas, Francis, that they threw away?
Many. Yeah. There were Nobel Prize winners. There was somebody like Enrico Fermi who, if he had not been here to do what he did, we might not have won World War II. There were famous artists. There were famous writers that were either American, Italian, or Americans. Of course, there were the sports figures and the figures from the world of music that were given. This committee threw everything out with no discussion. They only wanted to do what Rosa DeLauro wanted. And with that, I said, I can no longer deal with this kind of corruption. I'm out of here.
All right. Francis, listen, it's been a pleasure. You've laid it out very well. We'll keep an eye on it. It's an interesting story. And Francis Calzetta has been the guest.
We think we can win this because we have a lot of very, very good legalities that are involved in all this. They are just trying to cover up their bad behavior, and they do not want to pay the piper.
Check out the website, folks, the Facebook page, The American Italian, and that's hyphenated, The American Italian Women of Greater New Haven.
We don't use a hyphen.
Oh, you don't? Okay, so just American Italian Women.
Because we are Americans, and our heritage is Italian,
okay.
And the group is not limited to only people of Italian heritage. We have women who are not of Italian heritage who want to join us in our charitable works.
Excellent. Francis, stay in touch. I'll stay in touch with you, and we'll see how this goes down the road. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Paul.
Appreciate it. Francis Calzetta there, American Italian Women of Greater New Haven. Interesting lawsuit. And it's interesting that she said at the beginning that, you know, she personally spoke with the mayor, and the mayor pretty much, you know, Francis says, pretty much admitted to her that, as far as she told us, that he admitted the pressure he was under from, you know, different ethnicities in the city. Man, oh, man, can you imagine if they have to put the statue back on? And they are not happy with the I guess the design that is being favored now. It is an immigrant family, and I did see a mock-up of that design, I think, on News 12 earlier today. And the design does kind of, you know, it is And look, I admit I'm of Italian ancestry, and one of the neighborhoods she mentioned, Francis, did the Hill section of New Haven. That's where both of my sides of my family come from. But, yeah, I saw the proposed mock-up of this two kids and the father and the mother coming from Italy. And, yeah, the mother looked kind of like meek behind the father. The father was out front, you know, the mother holding the hands of the two kids or something like that with, you know, the babushka on top. And, you know, if that's what they were pushing for, you know, an Italian heritage statue, come on, you got to do better. You got to do better than that. Come on. We want to bring on our buddy, our pal. We check in with him about once a month, Mark Fitch, a writer for the Yankee Institute, the Fitch Files there. Check this one out, yankeeinstitute.org. Over the past 10 years, folks, you and I, when we renew our driver's licenses, when we renew our car registrations or get a new car, change ownership, whatever, we pay all these extra fees, this fee and that fee, greenhouse fee, the environment fee, the beaches fee, save the children, pet the animals, all this stuff that's supposed to make you feel good. Where does all this money go? And about $270 million of it, well, we're not sure. Mark Fitch delved into that. Mark, it's Paul here again. Good evening. How are you?
Good evening, Paul. Thanks for having me on.
I love this piece you did, Mark, because, you know, you and I and everybody, you know, we renew our car registration, we renew our licenses, and we look at all these fees and go, gosh, aren't I doing good for the environment? Well, Mark, as you write here, maybe, maybe not. What did you find happened maybe with $268 million over 10 years?
Well, basically, I looked at a couple different fees. One was the greenhouse gas reduction fee, which you'll see on your car registration. It's $5. And another called the Clean Air Act fee, which is also on your registration for $10. And I traced these fees back about 10 years. And like you said, comes out to about $268 million when you factor in the emission fees that we buy for a new car when we don't actually have to get emission inspections done on it. That money just goes straight to the government. But what I found with all these environmental fees, these clean air fees, these greenhouse gas fees, is at one point they went to something having to do with cleaning up the air and, you know, taking care of the environment. But then around 2009, they shifted all into the general fund and the special transportation fund, where they can be used for literally anything. So those fees, when you pay them, you say, oh, look at me, this must be going to something good because I'm helping the environment. Well, what the legislature decided to do instead was just take that money and use it to, you know, fill in budget deficits and whatever other kind of spending they feel like doing. I mean, once it goes into the great black hole of the general fund, it's pretty much hard to tell where it goes from there.
And Mark, I think you're accurate, and I said this yesterday when I was going over some of the numbers here. If people, Mark, are convinced and can be shown that the money they give any government, their town, their city, their municipality, the state, the feds, if it's going for what the government says it's going to go for, people are like, okay, this is good. But man, you know, Mark, this is the kind of stuff you and I talk about all the time that erodes trust little by little, drip by drip, erodes the trust that people have in government.
Exactly. And that's the thing, is these kind of fees, these kind of taxes, they get passed with a lot of fanfare and a lot of rhetoric involving, you know, saving the planet and global warming. And I went to the state library and looked up the legislative history of the greenhouse gas reduction fee. And it was all a lot of public posturing about global warming. And they had the fee in place for 3 years before they shuffled it right into the general fund and it disappeared. Except it didn't disappear for us. We still have to pay it, but the money itself went to just about anything. And you know, one of the reasons that I really looked into this is because now, you know, certain lawmakers and the governor's administration is asking for people to start paying an additional fee through the Transportation and Climate Initiative to do exactly what these fees were supposed to do, which is, you know, reduce emissions and clean up the air. So I was like, when I paid my registration, which was the inspiration for this article. I said, well, hold on a second. I said, you want us to pay higher gasoline prices to clean up emissions, but I'm looking at this greenhouse gas reduction fee, and it looks like we've been paying that for a little while, so why don't I go check that out? And it's the same rhetoric, it's the same discussion, you know, global warming, we have to reduce emissions. But in this case, for these particular fees, that money just kind of went into the government's checkbook, where they were able to spend it on whatever they like.
And Mark, and we're talking with Mark Fitch from the Yankee Institute, you know, people will tell me, and you've probably heard this well, can't they put safeguards in it once the money gets in there? Well, Mark, then we get things like, you remember the famous line, I think it was from Kathy Austin, well, we intercepted the money, you know, before it got there. I mean, there's really, Mark, is there not, maybe I'm wrong, you correct me, there's really no way, is there, to actually assure taxpayers that any funding really is going for anything in Hartford?
Well, the only way to, you can't even insure it, but the only way to really do it is to, you know, have people keeping an eye on it and watch where this money goes and call out politicians when they do something different. I mean, we can take this back to, the tolls debate when, you know, money was supposed to go into the special transportation fund and it got intercepted or diverted or whatever you want to call it. And, you know, speaking of interceptions and diversions, you know, when you pay your electric bill, you're also paying for, you know, greenhouse gas reduction fees and, you know, clean energy fees and things like that. And that goes into a special fund. And then in 2017, they took a lot of the money out of that special fund and left it, you know, in the red, essentially, for a couple years. And I went back and I looked at a couple other special funds that we had that either never produced what they said it was going to produce or were just raided and they took all the money. So you had, like, the Tobacco and Health Trust Fund.
Oh, that one.
You know, we got $2 billion from the United States settlement with the cigarette companies. The tobacco fund got $200 million, and then most of that got taken out, and the account was suspended. And then we had the school bus seatbelt fund, which was set up to collect money off when you lose your license and you have to get it reinstated. They charge you an extra $50 for that. That extra $50 was supposed to go into the school bus seatbelt fund, which it did, and then the lawmakers took it all out, and now the fund is gone. But we still have to pay that extra $50 if you have to reinstate your license. So the money goes to whatever they feel like, but we still have to keep paying the bill.
Mark, finally, when money like this, I've always wondered this, Mark, maybe you have the answer. When you have these shell games or these three-card Monty games, whatever you want to call them here with money, is there specific things the legislature has to do? In other words, does this chicanery sometimes need to have an on-the-record vote? Or do some of these things just happen kind of with a wink and a nod here? You know what I mean? I mean, is there a procedure here that's actually on the books? Do we know who said, okay, we're going to move this around or not?
You'd have to go back. Most of this happens during budgets. So that's when most of the time they're not going to just put it out there for a public hearing saying, well, you know, we have this really nice environmental fund that we like a lot, and it's got this money in it, but we want to take that money and put it somewhere else. They're not going to put that up for public debate and public comment. All this happens in the kind of backdoor negotiations that occur right before the budget gets passed, or it gets snuck into the budget implementer. So you don't really have a lot of record of people saying, yes, we're going, you know, it's not going to be Senator X says, yes, we're going to take the money to keep the children safe on the school bus and put it over here. Because no politician in the right mind would do that.
No.
But what you end up having is these backdoor negotiations during a budget session. And the budget comes out, and it's 900 pages long, and it takes a little while to get through it. And before you know it, that budget's passed, and the money has been shifted over. So, I mean, occasionally this pops up in maybe an appropriations hearing, but in general, they're going to shy away from doing something like that and generally only get called out on it after the fact.
Mark, once again, thanks for keeping an eye on this. I appreciate it. The listeners do. Check it out, folks, yankeeinstitute.org. Mark Fitch's latest piece, Connecticut drivers have paid hundreds of millions in clean air and emissions fees. Where did they go? Mark, thanks. Be good. We'll chat down the road, my friend. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Paul.
Appreciate it. That's it, folks. So there you go. You and I, we've ponied up about $270 million over 10 years, $27 million a year. That now is not going for what it was said it was going to go for, like to put safety belts on buses, which is amazing to me because you talk to a lot of public safety people. They don't like safety belts on buses. They look, if the bus rolls over, it's one thing. But a bus versus car on a level ground or a bus versus a few cars, the school bus is going to win. It's just going to win. A lot of public safety people don't like seatbelts on school buses. They want kids to be able to get off quick. But that stuff and all this greenhouse gas stuff, I mean, Mark is right. Anytime you want to shame somebody into paying something, just call it, just label it with something to do with greenhouse gas. That's all green. Yeah, but you know, you need to pay this because it'll eliminate greenhouse gas. Will it really? I don't know.